Frank Sinatra Room, the B.B. King Blues Room, the James Baldwin Library, just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
And welcome to Committee to Watch and Comment for Tuesday, July 9th. I'm Dave Raven. It's really great to be with you. I hope you're able to stay cool. We are suffering the effects of climate change, there's no question. Later in the show, the Institute for Policy Studies is kicking off its first annual Henry Wallace Symposium on July 22nd. The topic: Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the Heartland. This is not hyperbole. We are dealing with a confrontation with fascism in this country. It's rather crazy, but it's right in front of us. We'll speak with the IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies, Henry Wallace Fellowship Program Director, Atin Kumpfer. But first, the entire planet, as you well know, is suffering the consequences of climate change. Increases in heat are fueling more frequent and more powerful hurricanes, deadly heat waves, and wildfires, to list just a few of the effects of climate change. Ocean currents could be altered, which would bring drastic weather disruptions. It's a serious situation, folks. Every person and our entire ecosystem are affected. But people of color have to deal with a disproportionate amount of environmental stress. We're going to take a look at this issue locally on the program today. We'll start with a D.C. focus. The Prashanna Ambri, a board member of the Energy Justice Network, and a co-founder and coordinator of the One Love Co-op Network and the People's Justice Institute. Welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's really wonderful to have you. Appreciate your time. I know you're a busy gal with wearing a lot of hats. Let's talk about some of the environmental justice issues affecting D.C. You're concerned about overdevelopment. If you could talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, there's a number of things going on in D.C., right? Like, overdevelopment is definitely part of it. We're in a crowded space that's trying to crowd it further while people are still living here, right? So that leads to particle pollution and a host of other pollutants and neighborhoods that are essentially being attempted to be pushed out, right? If we're going to be real about it. And there are no legal restrictions on that, by the way, you know, on the amount of pollution that construction can bring. Then there's also the lack of housing air quality awareness. Most of us don't know the things that contribute to poor air quality in the homes, like changing our air filters, ventilating if we have gas stoves or ovens. I just found that out in the last several months from, you know, meeting different environmental activists. Even knowing our rights to change the pipes that are carrying our water, you know, understanding the impacts of lead that can chunk off into our water from our pipes and the effects that has on our brain, on our anger, and the disturbing statistics of, more lead found in low-income communities of color, who are also overrepresented in jails and prison, right? So there's a lot of very disturbing connections with environmental health and our mental health and our, you know, overall well-being. There's also, you know, the lack of knowledge of polluting facilities in DC that are overburdening Black and Brown communities. Ivy City, for example, there was a factory. There is a factory, National Engineering Product, and it is connected in a duplex to a family's house, you know, where a family lives. The family did not know that that house was connected to a factory, right? So her family members are, you know, encountering a host of health issues because of that, right? And she bought that house from HPAP, right? So, I mean, there are a lot of responsibilities that, you know, get left out, you know, and in terms of how our environment impacts our health. And there's also how DC impacts other places' environmental health as well, right? So DC, we dump our trash in Virginia, right? And in landfills in Virginia, and whether it's, if it's not getting in the landfills, it's going in the incinerator, which is also in Virginia, which is also far worse than the landfill itself in terms of air pollution, right? So how are we impacting other communities? So there's also river pollution. You know, there are folks working on the bottle bill over here to help us to be more cognizant of the litter that, you know, could end up in the runoff and the drains that ends up in our rivers and how that kills our ecosystem, right? And when we kill our ecosystem, we're killing us. We're harming ourselves slowly, right? So just a number of things that are in our environment that impact our health that oftentimes we're not even educated about. And these are all things that I myself have just been finding out from meeting environmental activists these last couple of years and organizing. So my job as a teacher, as a science teacher, I've been starting to incorporate some of this more in the curriculum that I teach the kids, but, you know, and change my actions, you know, work to compost more, recycling far more, you know, even looking at any sustainable products that I can switch over to so that I'm not adding more to landfills, you know, and toxic fumes to incinerators. So, yeah, it's a lot to really break down, but I think the simplest way to really understand it is that the environment, what is in the environment, impacts our health, and that starts from our home, you know, the indoor air quality, the indoor water quality, to what's outside of our homes, and just piecing those, you know, connecting those dots, piecing it all together, and make sure that both we're accountable as residents and the government, our local government, is accountable for our environmental health as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's terribly important. I mean, you're in Ward 7. How do you see people of color disproportionately affected by all the challenges that the climate change and the general drift of environmental challenges affecting people of color? How do you characterize that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's so we can start with like a concrete way, right? Like, so if you go to Ivy City, if you'll notice, has a lot of concrete and not a lot of trees, not a lot of green space, right? Compared to, let's say, if you go to you go to Chevy Chase, you could go to the Georgetown area, right? Lots more trees, right? Trees literally help us breathe better, right? They produce more oxygen. So if we're going to neighborhoods that have more concrete, you know, what's been termed as, you know, quote unquote, you know, concrete jungles, to quote Bob Marley, the air quality is going to drastically reduce as well, right? So so now add climate change, like you're saying, right? So now if you have hotter climates, hotter summer days, that's going to impact people who live in more concrete neighborhoods than people who live in more green neighborhoods, right? And unfortunately, that is where many low-income communities of color you know, have been placed, have lived, have oftentimes we don't have anywhere else to go but there. You know, and we deserve better. We deserve more green space. We deserve to be able to breathe at a higher quality, just like anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily an affirmative conscious effort on the powers of, shall we say, the powers that be, but people of color end up being victimized by a disproportionate amount of pollution and whatnot because of, you know, our economic system, our whole approach to dealing with energy in this country.
Definitely. Yeah, the I want to also highlight what's happening in Brentwood. Brentwood is overburdened already by many facilities. There's the trash transfer station. There's a construction company. I think there's salt facilities over there as well. And recently, they also decided to place a bus depot, a school bus depot over there, is where hundreds of buses, school buses from the district, would be going in and out. Now, that's just, it's just not reasonable. Like, it's that's not fair to any human being living there. That there's no other neighborhood that has that much going on down their street. Like, you know, I'll bring my students down there, and we'll just walk down the street, and you can feel it. As soon as you start walking, like, you don't want to be there. And the fact that Brentwood residents are forced to put up with that, and it's predominantly Black, is insane. And like you said, it does have to do with the history of white supremacy, the history of racism in this country, and it does have to do with the economic, you know, and political system that we're in, right? We're in a system, when you look up the definition of capitalism, right? Like, it is a system that is run by a profit motive, by private owners for profit, right? That is the actual definition of capitalism, right? When that's the case, when profit is always placed over human health, over people's well-being, we're always going to run into this problem of integrity, right? And accountability. But, you know, I think that when we start to shift and understand that politics really is about the people and about the well-being of the people and the land that we're, you know, charged to steward, and that holistic overview of both intertwined, then we can actually be in a system that allots for listening to what matters, you know? So thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's very serious, and it's not, as I said, it's not necessarily conscious. On a certain level, it doesn't make any difference. People with less political power have less say in what gets done, and people of color tend to be victimized by a disproportionate amount of environmental stress, shall we say, for lack of a better word, to the situation that is hand. You know, you wear a lot of hats, Prashanna. If you could talk about some of the other work that you're doing. Sounds sure. Really wonderful. You're educating young people. It just sounds terrific. If you could just...
The time
that we have left.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, so I've been blessed to help coordinate and co-found the One Love Cooperative Network. So it is a network to build intentional communities centered in Black, Indigenous, people of color, and just doing justice from the inside out, right? From learning self-awareness, holistic health, self-care, into understanding how the environment plays an impact in our health, to understanding, you know, the governance system that we're in and how we can advocate, you know, within that system. So it's a few components. It's just, you know, building a healthy, aware, and positive, an intentionally positive community. So I think it's just that decolonizing work, you know, because we have been colonized in a system that really hasn't valued human life at its core. You know, it's really just about decolonizing and getting back to really what matters. We do that through trips, through a farm to table program that we've started with Harvest to Health, which is a collective of Black farmers who don't use pesticides along the Eastern Shore and here, right outside of DC. And we go to the farm. We, you know, we learn how to get down with the land and how to grow crops in exchange for discounted grocery bags that we pick up seasonally, which, you know, anybody's welcome to join in on. And, you know, we do trips throughout the diaspora. We, you know, do civic actions and support one another. And we have a People's Justice Institute, which is a cooperative and civics training program that we've started on Instagram. So anybody can do it. We, you know, accessibility was huge because I know not everybody has time for like 1 hour, 2 hour long meetings all the time, but they might, you know, they do have time for a 2 minute Instagram video. So just so that we can, you know, build community and build awareness among each other. And we've been blessed this summer with that very first wave and class of interns through the Summer Youth Employment Program, Marion Barry's program. And they are amazing. Shout out to Alea, Chris, Dylan, Alonzo, Nate, Darce, you know, I hope I'm not missing anybody. I feel like I am. But all of my beautiful interns who've been supporting us to build out the People's Justice Institute. And all of it is all available on Instagram. You can go on my page, Brown Girls Think, and it's all there. And, you know, build with us. Join our efforts to build out an intentional community. And also shout out to Sankofa Homeschool Collective, where I get to teach decolonizing core academics and, you know, all the stuff that didn't get to make it into our public schools. You know, we work to get that to our homeschool students and out to the world on our YouTube and our Instagram pages for those who can't afford that. You know, so accessibility is key. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, it's wonderful. We're going to have to end it there. I've been speaking with Pashana Ambry, a board member of the Energy Justice Network, whose founder we're going to speak with next, and a co-founder. She's the co-founder and coordinator of the One Love Co-op Network and the People's Justice Institute. Pashana Ambry, thank you so much for all you do. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you so much.
Really appreciate you and all you're doing. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll focus now on environmental justice issues in Prince George's County. It's the wealthiest Black community, the Black county in the United States. We're joined by Robin Lewis, Director for Climate Equity at Interfaith Power and Light for the DMV, and Mike Ewall, Founder and Executive Director of the Energy Justice Network. Do we have you all with us? Okay. Are you with us, Robin?
I am here. Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
It's great. It's great to have you. Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us. And we would really appreciate callers checking in. I believe that the largest segment of our listening audience is in Prince George County, right next to DC, and it doesn't get enough attention in my estimation. We would really like to hear from you. 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Please call in with your questions, comments, suggestions. We would really I'd like to hear from you. Robin Lewis, you're a longtime activist in the county. You're the Director of Climate Equity at Interfaith Power and Light for the DMV. Talk about your organization. I hadn't heard of it, and it sounds absolutely wonderful. You're biblically shepherds of the earth, I believe. It's wonderful.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. Well, Interfaith Power and Light has been around. We are an affiliate of the national organization, and we're the DMV affiliate, and we work with congregations across the D.C., Maryland, Northern Virginia area to educate and promote environmental and climate justice issues, as well as, you know, help bring congregations into the conversation about advocacy and advocating for the communities that they serve. My focus is on all different faiths, but in particular, I'm focused on the Black church. And, you know, educating, bringing not only sustainable practices to houses of worship in the area, but also bringing knowledge, resources, bringing them into the legislative process so that they can advocate for the communities or connect with the communities that they're actually serving. So that's my role now. But I've been in environmental justice for over a decade. And Mike has joined us, and I've worked with Mike forever. So actually, he was kind of instrumental in getting me educated about environmental justice. And I'm going to let Mike go. But, you know, that's me in a nutshell, really quickly. So you're on, Mike.
Okay. Thank you, Robin. And thank you, David, for having me. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Wonderful. Mike Ewall, he's the founder and executive director of the Energy Justice Network. If you could give an overview, I think it's really important. People don't realize it, the day-to-day events going on with environmental issues. If you could give an overview of your perception of what environmental issues, the interface between environmental issues and the demographics, how gentrification has pushed people out of D.C. I mean, something it's really important, and it's a slow process, and people don't necessarily see it, but it's important. And it's all related with demographics and economics and such. If you could talk about that.
Absolutely. So there are a lot of environmental racism hotspots, as we would call them, in the D.C. area. In D.C. itself, you've got the fact that most of the noxious infrastructure, trash transfer stations, the sewage treatment plant, power plants, all of these have been clustered and located in Black neighborhoods in the city. And with the waste system, as Shona was explaining, after the trash goes from small trucks to big trucks in those transfer stations in Black neighborhoods in D.C., most of that gets trucked out to an incinerator in Norton, Virginia, which is one of the most diverse communities of color in the country and has the biggest air polluter in at least 25 miles of D.C. It's one of the largest trash incinerators in the nation. And they have three landfills and a sewage sludge incinerator on top of that surrounding that community. So you see this trend where that incinerator, the one also a smaller one in Alexandria, also in a community of color, and that's just the trend in the region. So the issue with gentrification tying in, as Prashona was mentioning, I remember between the 2000 and 2010 censuses, three of the five most whitening zip codes in the nation, in other words, Black people being pushed out and white people moving in, were right down the middle of D.C. along the Green Line, which I call the gentrification line. And a lot of Black people get pushed out into Prince George's County, Charles County, getting pushed east, where people sometimes jokingly call Prince George's County Ward 9 of D.C., because that's where a lot of D.C. residents get pushed. But when I first moved to D.C., I remember looking up on our mapping project. We have ejmap.org is where we track a lot of power plants and waste facilities. And I noticed that there were three power plants within the Beltway. Two are in Black neighborhoods in D.C. These were burning oil in Buzzard Point and Benning Road. And there was a coal-fired power plant in Alexandria, which is not a community of color, but it's blowing directly downwind toward the blackest part of D.C. in Ward 8. And all three of those shut down in 2012. However, at the same time, three new fossil fuel power plants were being planned, and being planned in the same places where Black residents of D.C. were being displaced. And these were in Brandywine, two of them in Prince George's County, one in nearby Waldorf in Charles County. And Brandywine already had a gas fire power plant. And there was a fifth power plant in this cluster in Eagle Harbor, another Black community in Prince George's County, which there was burning coal for many years, but is now mostly burning gas. So you have several clusters of environmental racism hotspots just in Prince George's County. You've got Brandywine with the two power plants, then you almost got a third, toxic waste sites, a coal ash dump that thankfully is now closed because they stopped burning coal at two nearby power plants, and one of the largest in the nation, contaminated soil processing plants. That's just in Brandywine alone. Then you've got Upper Marlboro with the state's only sewage sludge incinerator, multiple landfills, another contaminated soil processing plant, and more. Then you got Eagle Harbor, like I mentioned, with the other power plant. And a fourth hotspot is just west of Cheverly near DC, where you have aggregate industries, asphalt plants, and waste facilities clustered. So this is not something you usually see in white communities. Now, there is one example in the region where you have pretty big clustering, and that's in Dickerson in Montgomery County, which is a relatively affluent white rural community, where Montgomery County puts all of its unwanted stuff. But the biggest polluter there is a trash incinerator. And that trash incinerator, all of their toxic ash exclusively targets Black communities, most recently in Virginia, where the ash gets dumped. So even in cases like that, you have environmental racism dimensions to the issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's insidious. You know, I think that's the right word. You know, it's a question of political power and economic power, and people of color get pushed into Prince George's County largely as an effect of gentrification, and they have less political power, and they suffer the results with these incinerators being placed, these power plants, these landfills being placed in the county in a disproportionate manner. And whether it's conscious or not, it's an environmental justice issue. People of color are disproportionately affected by what's going on in terms of energy generation. If you could just talk in very general terms about that, Mike Ewald.
Sure, I'll be brief so Robin can get into some more details on Prince George's County. But we've studied national trends in this, in a lot of waste and energy industries, and found what previous studies have found, that race is more of a factor than class. So just like Lorton, Virginia, just like Prince George's County, these are not poor areas for the most part, but these are areas where people of color live, and that's why they get targeted more than a similar community might be. If you were flipping the variables around. And so we've looked at this across a lot of different industries, and there are some that affect poor white communities more than others. There's one anomaly where nuclear power plants, because in the 70s they thought they were clean, so they built them in white communities predominantly, and not ones that are poor for the most part. But other parts of that industry are some of the worst environmental racism examples we've seen, like uranium mining and nuclear waste dumping for indigenous people. It's the worst we've seen in any industry. So you can't really escape it. It crosses a lot of different industries and a lot of communities.
Go ahead, David.
Yes, please, Robin Lewis, chime in, please.
Sure. So I just wanted to add, you know, as a result of these air pollutants, in addition to all the plants that Mike brought up, of course, there's truck traffic going to these places. So we're increasing smog and increasing environmental toxins that way, you know, from breathing. And all of this leads to health disparities and health issues. You know, as we mentioned, you know, air pollution creates all kinds of issues from a health perspective, and I just want to chime in on, and even the American Lung Association, they rated Prince George's County an F last year. It's got upgraded to a D, which is not better. So it's still bad. And, you know, the percentage of asthma is very high in the county, in addition to other COPD and other health disparities that are that occur in the county as a result of environmental hazards that people are actually ingesting and breathing in to their system. And over time, we see other disparities that are related to being exposed to environmental toxins. And people, as Mike mentioned, they're predominantly Black county. People are being pushed to Charles County as well. And Charles County has just as many environmental issues. It's just Prince George's County is bigger and has more people. So this is a problem because it leads to health issues. That's how it relates to people, you know. So
just Robin Lewis, you're the director for the climate equity at Interfaith Power and Light for the DMV. If you could talk about your organization, it's very interesting. It's faith-based, church-based, and, you know, the whole idea of being shepherds for the planet. If you could talk about that, I think it's really important.
Sure, absolutely. Because I'm coming in with an environmental justice perspective, you know, my perspective is always about the community and always about, you know, how is a community being impacted? And we really feel that faith-based organizations have a lot of power in terms of educating communities, as well as engaging in community activism and helping the community move itself into a more sustainable way, and also advocating for things that the community doesn't have. So the Interfaith Power and Light, and my role there, is really to bring faith communities together to build power for the community. Some of the things that we're working on and we've done, we've worked with the University of Maryland, the organizations there, and Dr. Jacoby and his team at the University of Maryland have been pushing for air quality monitors to be in place around. We've placed approximately 80 air quality monitors with the help of various congregations on churches to monitor. So we're doing community science so we can use that information to promote different environmental justice, legislative, policies and things like that. We're also working on, and we've studied indoor air pollution in terms of, you know, gas appliances in people's homes. So we've done a whole program around that with other EJ groups in the region and determined that there's so much leakage in homes from their own gas appliances. And we're trying to help people and congregations understand what they can do, you know, in terms of moving away from fossil fuel burning in the home. Those are some of the basic things that we've worked on. We're also working with other organizations that are trying to address food insecurity. That's another other issue that's an environmental justice issue, having food deserts. Prince George's County has approximately estimated about 20 areas that are food insecure, that don't have groceries within a half a mile of 30% of the population. So we're trying to address all of these issues, along with helping churches grow, not just grow food on their property, on their houses of worship, on their sanctuary, their property, but also develop sacred grounds for native plants and solar. I mean, so many congregations have place solar on their congregations, and we're encouraging community solar. So we're trying to attack it from the injustice as well as the solutions perspective to bring the community together with congregations to promote justice in Prince George's County and elsewhere.
Wonderful. It's such important work. I commend you. Mikey, well, if you could talk about your Energy Justice Network? I mean, you were, I think you went to law school in the D.C. area, and but now you've expanded to a national view. If you could talk about the Energy Justice Network.
Sure. Energy Justice Network is a group that's about 25 years old now, and we've been working to help communities all over the country fight dirty energy and waste facilities. We have been a special focus on environmental justice, environmental racism, focusing on the communities that need the most support in battling those sorts of things. And we also sometimes will work on the positive sides as well, on clean energy and zero waste solutions and policies around it. But predominantly, we're playing defense and helping create the space for the good stuff by knocking out proposals for new incinerators and other sorts of dirty energy and waste industry facilities. And we've been so successful at that as a movement over the years that we don't have as many new things to fight as we used to. And we've been working a lot to help shut down existing major polluters, particularly focused on trash incinerators.
Yeah, it's just such important work, and appreciate all that you're doing. Both of you are, shall we say, in the trenches, and you can check out their work. Just Google Environmental Justice Network and Interfaith Power and Light, which is a national organization. Robin Lewis is with the DMV chapter. I want to thank you very much for all you're doing. I want to thank you for joining us today. Appreciate
it. Dave, if I can correct real quick, it's Energy Justice Network. So energyjustice.net will help you find us. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you both for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
On to our last, I guess the Institute for Policy Studies is kicking off its first annual Henry A. Wallace Symposium on July 22nd, not far away. The topic, Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland. And joining us now to talk about this important and, shall I say, timely symposium is the Institute for Policy Studies Henry Wallace Fellowship Program Director in Comfort. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, David.
Really appreciate it. So a lot of folks out there, believe it or not, have no idea who Henry Wallace was, a really important person. If you could talk about Henry Wallace.
Yeah, thank you for this invitation. So Henry Wallace was the vice president under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, from 1941 to 1944. And previously served as the Secretary of Agriculture from 1933 to 1940. So he was a key architect of the New Deal and one of its leading evangelists. He was also someone who was a real spiritual seeker, who had a clarity of moral vision that many other high elected officials and appointees lacked. And so he really carried that into all of his work. So during FDR's first two terms, he developed a broad following among farmers, union activists, and progressives. He really helped to meet the moment in terms of the crisis in falling farm prices and refashioned the USDA as one of the leading agencies in the country. So in the late 1920s, this is the moment really when almost half of Americans made their living directly or indirectly from agriculture. So Wallace saw that farmers were not only not sharing in the prosperity of the 1920s, but their plight really plummeted dramatically with the economic crash in 1929. So farm income fell by 2/3 and foreclosures are happening at a record pace. So Wallace really steps in at the invitation of Roosevelt and begins to develop, how can we think about the combination of better farm management and government relief? So he's the key advocate behind things like the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the Rural Electrification Administration, soil conservation, as well as things that you know many of us know and think of today, like the food stamp and the school lunch programs. So he's really an innovator in all these regards. And he's invited to become, because he's so popular, he's invited by Roosevelt to join the ticket in 1940. And he really becomes Roosevelt's right-hand man, also in relationship to the war effort. So by the late 1980s, he's really alarmed by the rise of fascist dictatorships taking place in Germany, Italy, and Japan. This is a period when many in the Midwest, so I should say too, he was from Iowa, from a prominent farming family. Many in the Midwest were isolationists in this moment, and he was really trying to think about what could collective security look like. Oh, excuse me. During World War II, FDR involves Wallace in all these military and international matters and sends Wallace traveling for him. And it's in 1942, Wallace delivers this incredible talk that contains the phrase, the century of the common man. So he's trying to think about how the U.S. can come out of this moment, building a world of peaceful cooperation.
I mean, it's so important. People were talking about the 20th century being the American century, and Wallace was talking about the century being the century for the common man. It inspired the composer Aaron Copland to write, you know, Fanfare for the Common Man. I mean, Wallace was the real deal, you know, in a way that I don't think most politicians are. I mean, the guys from Iowa, from agricultural country, from the heartland, and he really inspires a very sincere and honest expectation about the common man in America.
Exactly. So he's counterposing this idea, the idea of the American century, with the century of the common man, and really trying to think about this notion of a global New Deal. But coming out of that, so, you know, he's very concerned about the rise of fascism. And in 1944, so this is April 1944, as the convention is approaching, he pens an op-ed for the New York Times on the dangers of American fascism.
And we should emphasize, we're not talking about fascism as in Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy. We're talking about American fascism, and that's what Wallace is addressing. If you could talk about that article.
Exactly. Yeah. So what he really points to this notion that, you know, there is the potential for fascism in the United States, and it really arrives at the intersection of what he argues three different things: for racism and nativism, mass media manipulation, and untrammeled corporate power and monopoly power. So he's concerned about how those three things can work together to really promote a kind of homegrown U.S. fascism. And he argues that, quote, the symptoms of fascist thinking are colored by environment and adapted to their immediate circumstances, but always and everywhere there can be identified by their appeal to prejudice and by the desire to play upon the fears and vanities of different groups in order to gain power. So he offers this really prescient analysis that I think actually speaks to our moment 80 years later, you know, thinking at this intersection of how do kind of histories of racism work together with misinformation and the pursuit of like corporate profit. How does that intersection really drive the threat of fascism? And I think it's certainly something we can think about being relevant to our own moment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I think of fascism, you know, if you look at Hitler, if you look at Germany during the war, it's the fusion of the government with the corporate sector. And that is certainly, it's an ongoing threat in the United States, be it under a Democrat or a Republican administration, particularly, I think, under a Republican administration. I mean, I'm thinking of, for example, there apparently was a meeting or early in the year between various corporate executives and Donald Trump, and Trump said, "You get me $1 million, and I'll eviscerate, if I'm reelected, any or most regulations concerning corporate actions." If you could talk about that, I mean, it's rather stark what we're facing now. I'm not exactly, and many of our listeners are not exactly Joe Biden fans, but it's all relative.
Yeah, so I do think, yeah, there's this real issue that he's pointing to in terms of the ways that, like, narratives around sort of white supremacy and white resentment that can be used to speak to what are real worsening economic circumstances faced by many communities, how they can be mobilized in pursuit of other ends, and particularly corporate profit. One of the things that I think Wallace is also prescient about in the article, he also talks about how those who would seek to profit from war and war making, whether financially or politically, can be fascists. And he says, quote, "One who in cases of conflict puts money and power ahead of human beings." So I think thinking too about the ways in which sort of the pursuit of war or violence as a means towards some other end can also be its own form of fascism. But one of the things I think is really powerful about Wallace is he doesn't just sort of stop with that analysis. And the reason that we, you know, are excited to host this symposium is because he also promotes solutions. So in the end of the article, he talks about a number of things that he think can be sort of antidotes to the threat of authoritarianism. He talks about promoting economic democracy, right? In terms of like the Economic Bill of Rights that FDR had outlined just earlier that year in a State of the Union address that would really speak to kind of broader forms of economic security and endowed rights. He also talks about the need to like prize full employment over corporate profit and the need to renew democracy both locally and nationally. So the idea that like democratic renewal needs to happen sort of all levels of the country. And finally, he argues for the development of scientific research and technology in service to the uplifting of the common man. You know, we today, of course, say the common person. But I think it's really interesting, too, and to think about our own moment when, you know, so much of technology and R&D goes directly to corporate profit and you know, often isn't really serving human needs.
Yeah. I mean, I need to do a whole show on, you know, is capitalism antithetical to democracy? I mean, your upcoming symposium is kind of an expression of that. I mean, it seems like capitalism, you know, with concentration of wealth and with that accompanying political power, tend to override democracy. We're not talking about one man, one vote. We're talking about the power of the do-re-mi. And Henry Wallace was just such an extraordinary proponent of countering that, of espousing the value and the importance of the common man. And you've got a wonderful symposium coming up on July 22nd with a great panel. If you could talk about that, because that's the primary reason why we have you on today. Exactly, and yeah. You've got a great panel. If you could talk about your esteemed guests, one of which John Nichols has been on our program more than once.
Yes, exactly. So we're excited. Coming up on Monday, July 22nd, starting at 6:30, we'll be at the Bus Boys and Poets at the 14th and V location for the event Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland. So it's a joint event hosted by us at the Institute for Policy Studies, as well as our colleagues at the Wallace Global Fund and The Nation magazine. And so for the first annual Henry A. Wallace Symposium, we're going to feature a talk by John Nichols. So John Nichols from The Nation, who wrote the book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. So we'll be hearing a little bit about why he thinks Wallace's vision remains relevant to our contemporary moment, but then we'll open it up into a wider conversation. So we'll be joined by Salma Arias, who's the executive director of People's Action, and as well as a member of the board of Institute for Policy Studies. And then the conversation will be facilitated by Tope Falerin, who's the executive director of IPS. And part of what we're going to be asking is how can this sort of moral vision of thinking about challenging fascism through having a sort of a forthright vision for what the country could look like that really brings together questions of racial and economic justice. We're going to ask how that kind of vision can inform the contemporary moment. So we'll be talking about the challenges of rising fascism and how social movements are working to counter them on the local level. And particularly, we'll be thinking about the Midwest and the South. You know, these are not places that one always thinks of when you think about sort of progressive spaces in this country. But actually, they're home to some of the most innovative and groundbreaking campaigns, whether it's, you know, the UAW drive to unionized auto plants across the South, or efforts to bring together migrants with farming communities, right? And to really challenge some of these narratives around who belongs, right? And so we think there's a lot of hope and a lot that we can learn from looking to these pockets of the country that often get ignored in discussions of progressive politics. And so we think there's a lot of lessons that can come out of that. And particularly for us, you know, if you want to build a nation and ultimately a world that can hold this large and progressive bold vision for our future, it's going to take all of us, and we are going to have to really challenge the idea that only certain places should be focuses of our organizing and our energy. So that's part of what we'll be talking about together on Monday the 22nd. And I do just want to take the opportunity to tell people how to register for the event. So if you go to ips-dc.org, so it's the event is actually there on our homepage at the bottom of the homepage, but the actual URL to get there is ips-dc.org/events/countering-American-fascism. And so, yeah, we've got limited availability in the room, but we really do want to pack the house for the conversation. You can also sign up to participate and watch the live stream there as well. Yeah, we hope it's the first of many Wallace symposiums, and want to continue this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very important. You know, fascism, I think, at times gets thrown around loosely, but we're clearly facing it. And it's not just Donald Trump. It's a whole movement that everyone needs to be aware of, and everyone need to, if they're of a mind, to counter. I mean, there's a Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, and it's a curse, and we are certainly living in interesting times that people need to be aware of what's going on. So do check out IPS Institute for Policy Studies -dc.org, very much an ORG. It's being held, the symposium, as a Busboys and Poets, which is a creation of Andy Shalal, who has a show on our program. And our dear Nefa has a show on our program as well, from the staff of IPS, a very important organization. This should be quite an evening, July 22nd. Do check out the symposium. I want to thank Tim Comfort. He's the IPS Henry Wallace Fellowship Program Director. Thank you for all you're doing, and thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you, David, for the invitation and for letting us help spread the word.
really appreciate it. That'll do it for today's show. Before we go, I want to alert you to an important special tonight, this Tuesday night from 6 to 8 on WPFW, your station for Jazz and Justice, reversing the healthcare access crisis for DC's underserved radio forum on Unity Healthcare Clinics and the DC Jail. Participants include Unity Healthcare providers, DC council members, community activists. Please listen tonight, 6 to 8, on WPFW-FM, your station for Jazz and Justice. Thank you so much to Amazing Magic Mike for his engineering expertise. Coming up, the WPFW news headlines, and followed by the wonderful Lady Murr. But don't forget the blues. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Have a great week. Take care.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Russian airstrikes hit a children's hospital in Ukraine yesterday, alongside other targets in Kyiv and other cities, killing a total of at least 42 people. Over 100 people were injured across several cities. Local medical officials and international leaders reacted to the hospital bombing with rage. The hospital's director general said a wing that focused on dialysis for children was, quote, ruined entirely. A UN official said at least 7 children were injured in the bombing and said casualties would have been much higher if patients hadn't been taken to a bunker when air raid sirens sounded. Russia denied responsibility for the strike, blaming it instead on a Ukrainian air defense missile. The UN official said the strike was almost certainly a Russian cruise missile. Investigators with the International Criminal Court visited the hospital today to collect evidence of potential war crimes. Voters in France on Sunday denied power to the far right in a surprise election result. A coalition of left-wing groups earned a plurality of votes on Sunday, while the centrist group of President Emmanuel Macron came in second place. The results follow a tumultuous week of political deal-making in which leftist and centrist candidates strategically backed out of races to consolidate opposition to the far right. Still, Marine Le Pen and her National Rally Party won 143 seats in parliament, much more than the 89 seats they won 2 years ago, which at the time was an unprecedented victory for the far right. No faction won a majority of seats in parliament, and the leftist and centrist groups appear reluctant to negotiate. Israeli forces are continuing to push back into Gaza City in search of militants who have regrouped there. Thousands of Palestinians fled areas of Gaza City already ravaged by fighting over the 9-month war. Hamas warned that the Israeli operation could cause ceasefire talks to collapse, despite apparent recent progress in negotiations. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released a statement on Sunday also casting doubt on negotiations, saying he would only accept a peace deal that would, quote, allow Israel to resume fighting. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians still live in northern Gaza after it was targeted in the first weeks of the war. Most of the territory's population is displaced. Leaders of the NATO military alliance are gathering in Washington, D.C. today amid the war in Ukraine, and as President Biden seeks to demonstrate his mental competence following a disastrous debate performance earlier this month. European heads of state are grappling with the idea that Biden could lose November's election to Trump, who in his last term expressed skepticism about the NATO alliance and threatened to withhold funding. 6 elected Democrats in the House have publicly called on Biden to quit his campaign, while many others have reportedly talked to him in private about stepping aside. Biden is seeking to use the multi-day NATO event, including meetings with heads of state and a solo press conference, to dispel doubts among fellow Democrats. Some NATO allies, including German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, have said publicly they don't have any concerns about Biden's health. And recovery and cleanup efforts are underway today after Hurricane Beryl slammed into southern Texas as a Category 1 hurricane yesterday, knocking out power to more than 2.5 million homes and leaving at least eight people dead in Texas and Louisiana. As of this morning, more than 2.3 million homes and businesses throughout Texas are still without power, according to the website poweroutage.us. Meanwhile, more than 21 million people